This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Last week, I called up Atul Gawande to talk about COVID in the United States and in India.
My father comes from a village in the state of Maharashtra, which is the hardest hit state so far. And my mother's from Gujarat, where we also still have family. So I've been in regular contact getting WhatsApp updates.
What are you hearing?
Well, you know, it has totally flipped from the period when we were having 300,000 to 400,000 infections a day, and now it's the other way around. And it is running through entire households like wildfire. I have elderly relatives who've ended up in the hospital and made it through, and then a cousin my age who I never would have thought would have been hit so bad, and he died. And he died from this.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and I'm nothing compared to what I know of other families and what they're going through.
Atul Gawande is a surgeon in Boston, and he runs a company called CIC Health, which provides COVID-19 testing and vaccines. He's also a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and an expert on public health.
The big difference from the United States experience is that you have such a fragile and underfunded healthcare system, and you know, the hospitals just became overrun and overwhelmed, and it really has had this feeling of being on your own. That said, in Maharashtra, where the infection started, they have plateaued and the cases have started to come down as people lock down. And the core lesson is we do know how to stop this.
We're going to come back to the situation in India, which is really dire, but I want to ask you first about the United States. For close to a year now, all we could think about was, when are we going to get a vaccine? And now, at this point, more than 100 million Americans are vaccinated, and we're starting to see demand fall, in fact, plummet in some places. Some sites have closed for lack of interest, amazingly enough. So please give me a sense of what this means for the vaccine rollout in the States. What's happening?
I mean, what's happening here is mostly the upside of a successful acceleration of the rollout. We're working our way through the people who were desperately seeking vaccination, and we knew we would come to this point. The remaining people fall into three groups. One is the group who would do it if you made it really easy. The second group are those who are have a lot of questions and concerns. Want to, above all, talk to their physician about it, but are likely to be vaccinated if their concerns are addressed. And, you know, I'd put into that group, there's a good third of people who are afraid of needles out there. And then there is the 10 to 15% group that has not budged, who are dead set against. And honestly, if we can get through those other populations, I think we will do fine.
And yet we're hearing about the impossibility of herd immunity because of the vaccine resistance.
I'm skeptical that we can get to herd immunity for a number of reasons. Number one is, you know, what is the right number of people to get vaccinated in order for the epidemic to collapse? Maybe it's 90% with the new variants, and that may be a reason why we don't get to herd immunity. Another reason is that we know that there are animal reservoirs, including pets, including other animals in our environment that can keep the virus circulating potentially. And then, yes, you know, if 30% of the country never gets vaccinated, it's very unlikely we will knock this down, knock it out completely. But in my mind, the target has been, can we get this to be less than the flu? You know, the flu is just north of 100 deaths a day in a typical year. And if we can get COVID-19 down to 100 deaths a day or fewer, we're in an entirely different world. We are not near that. We're still, you know, 600 to 700 deaths a day, and we have a ways to go.
Let's talk about persuasion, the campaign for persuading vaccine-hesitant people to get a vaccine. it amazes me, Atul, that when I turn on either look at social media, or I turn on television, or whatever it is, I'm not seeing countless celebrities of different kinds appeal to everyone in this country to get out.
Yeah.
I don't see this. I don't understand it.
Well, there are a couple of things. Number one, the celebrity appeals have proven not to work. What people believe are when they hear from their own health professionals, when they hear from their own community and their family members. And so, you know, what's interesting is you'd just be pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into ads that were kind of turning people off more than turning people on. What does work is a combination of getting the vaccine into the hands of local providers, getting the ground game going. And what we have had has been an incredible success with mass vaccination centers, come to stadiums, come to other sites. And that has to now shift. Our team, which has run a vaccination at Gillette Stadium and with FEMA, has shifted now to almost 20 different sites. You know, we're about to have approval for 12 to 15-year-olds. I want to see us offering in every high school around the country vaccination to all the kids whose parents make it possible for them to do it. That's the thing that I want to see much more of. Less the ads, and much more that in every
good point
community, you are hearing that this is moving now out of the stadiums and into these pop-up capabilities.
So vaccine trials are now underway for kids. How will the equation around herd immunity change, if at all, once we start vaccinating children?
It's a difficult equation for kids, because although kids are also dying from this disease, you know, we have a children's hospital here with ICU beds full of kids who have serious complex inflammatory syndromes. Having people understand, the parents and the kids, that this is for their benefit, getting vaccinated, that it is to their good, and these vaccines have only rare serious side effects. That's going to take significant persuasion. And it's not much of a sell, especially to parents, that we want our kids vaccinated in order to protect the entire community.
That is quite disturbing to hear, that it's not a very good sell to appeal to community.
Up and down in the United States, it has not been a successful sell to say, roll up your arm for the sake of your community, for the sake of the country.
This is, I don't mean to linger over this point, but this is a country that prides itself, or has historically, on, I will sign up for the army and risk my life for the sake of protecting this country, its values, but not to take a needle shot in the arm so that others, as well as yourself, might not die. That seems terrible.
I think there is pride in people who've taken the shot that they have done something to help others as well. But when you're talking about the reluctant community who have not yet stepped up to get the vaccination, all the surveys, all the focus groups indicate that that is not the persuasive argument.
Now, I know you helped advise the Biden administration during the transition on this crisis. How would you grade how the Biden administration has helped or not helped the effort in India?
Well, a week ago, I would have and was giving it very poor scores, because there have been weeks of discussion about the fact that we have bought tens of millions of doses of AstraZeneca vaccine, which has not even gone through the approval process here, will expire at some point and can be given to the rest of the world, when we clearly have supplies, more than sufficient supplies. As you said, our supplies are already exceeding demand in the United States. Now, what you see is a remarkable undertaking, which is not only the release of the doses of AstraZeneca vaccine, but then also a commitment of enough dollars to support the manufacturing of 1 billion more vaccines in India. The support is starting to get there, and it's the U.S. and it's many other parts of the world.
Should President Biden pressure Pfizer, Moderna to lift the IP strictures, if not give it away, then lower the prices vastly to help places like India Brazil, Nigeria?
Yes. What I would say is that there's much more complexity to it than that, unfortunately. The complexity is, first of all, India is the vaccine supplier to the world, and they're unsurprisingly needing to focus on delivering their vaccine locally. We have to generate much more supply of vaccine around the world, and building that supply is going to be a lot more than just saying release the IP. What we really need are the companies to support building factories in every major region of the world. And I agree with those who say it just seems morally unconscionable for us to have hoarded and controlled supply while the rest of the world is being told that they may not receive enough supply until 2022.
You know, someone said statistics are just numbers with the tears washed away. This is a moment in which we see that statistics as numbers with tears washed away.
Siddhartha Mukherjee wrote recently for The New Yorker about how the pandemic was hitting countries all over the world quite differently, with particular attention to India, where he grew up. India is now reporting nearly 4,000 deaths a day from COVID. But experts think that the real toll may be many times higher than that. And the promises made by the Biden administration, Mukherjee says they're not going to suddenly save the day.
For a country of 1.3 billion people, 60 million doses, as you can imagine, is three zeros away or two zeros away. And so it is a nominal gesture, but of course an important gesture. India right now needs locally made vaccines. Now, we still do not know the extent to which these vaccines can or cannot counter the variants that are prevalent in India, the 1617 and the 117 strain that are predominant in India.
So to be clear, we don't know how good or bad they are, and there's not enough of it. And from abroad, what's being donated, what's being given is a drop in the ocean. Overall, Sid, what you're suggesting is extremely dark, which is to say that the capacity for India to turn this around in reasonably rapid fashion is dire.
Well, so it depends on what dark means to you. So let me organize the priorities. The priority number one is to get oxygen to sites where they need oxygen. You and I and others sitting outside India can't really help because this is a federal Indian priority using trains, using potentially the army. The second priority is setting up field hospitals and potentially using the army to create these field hospitals where people really need help. And the third is, of course, vaccines and vaccinations. If those are done really quickly, I think we can decompress by 50 to 75% the situation in the hospitals in India. But unless all these three pillars work in coordination, I just don't see a way ahead. Is it dark? Yes, it's dark. I mean, the fire is burning in crematoria every day. My friend's father died 2 days ago. But on the other hand, I think it's a kind of all hands on deck situation.
And is the crisis centered in the cities?
The crisis is largely centered in the cities and in urban slums. But of course, it's leaking everywhere. It's leaking into villages, leaking into everywhere else. But at least in these cities, the presence of field hospitals would be very helpful. They have been set up before. India knows how to do them. And so the crisis can be handled at least in the prima facie level at that way.
Sid, we are more than a year into this pandemic. And I have to say that among my first thoughts a year ago was this is going to especially affect a place like India, particularly in its cities, which are so dense and in so many instances poor, and the infrastructure is what you describe. And yet that's not what we were hearing for quite a while. Was that just a matter of American self-obsession, or was there truly a lag, a delay before the worst hit India, and why?
I think there was a lag and a delay before it hit India, and there are several reasons. One is that the Indian population is younger. So the average median age in India is 28 years as opposed to 40 odd years in the United States and Italy and Spain and other places. So there was that fact. There was also the idea that India encountered the so-called old strain of COVID, the original strain of COVID. And it seemed to sort of manage that old strain with 150 odd thousand deaths, which of course per capita, given the population of India, is vastly less than the United States or even Belgium or other places. And so there was a brief moment of reprieve in which we in India sensed that the worst had been over. I think a vast degree of political complacency and a lack of preparedness, some degree, which we still don't know yet, of a new strain arriving, and some degree of the collapse of public infrastructure. And really, this is a warning to other countries and other countries to prepare for a second wave and a third wave and a fourth wave of the pandemic. Don't think of this as a local problem, but as a global problem. 1617 and 117 are already in the United States. It's not as if we're protected. Vaccine hesitancy in this situation is a disaster. Because if it turns out that Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, even though they produce enough antibodies, are not sufficient to protect you against these new strains that are emerging, understand that this is going to come to America before you know it.
Sid, I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Siddhartha Mukherjee is an oncologist at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia Medical Center. His books include The Gene. And I spoke earlier with staff writer Atul Gawande, who's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and the author of Being Mortal and other books. After I spoke with Sid and Atul, the Biden administration came out in support of releasing IP protections for the major COVID vaccines. Now the question goes to negotiators at the World Trade Organization. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, over the past year, during the long pandemic, your relationship with your clothes closet has probably changed a little bit.
I am wearing a hoodie and sweatpants and flip-flops. I mean, come on.
I've only worn clothes that can go in the washer-dryer.
I believe that I described my clothing choices to my employer as sack wear.
In addition to the already current face mask, I am adding a more design-friendly second face mask. And one of those, in particular, is this Jurassic Park Samuel L. Jackson one that has him saying, "Hold on to your butts."
I like to dress up.
Ever since the pandemic happened, I have personally found myself dressing in a more formal way.
I put on jeans in the morning. It just makes me feel like still a citizen of the world.
But now those of us who are working at home, and that's more than half of working Americans, at least part-time, we're starting to think about what going back to the office will be like. What exactly is it going to be? And we're thinking about all this with a measure of trepidation.
I'm reluctantly going to retire my outdoor slippers, which differ from my indoor slippers.
Dresses? I don't know if I'm down with them anymore. I really don't.
I don't think I'm going to miss anything about my pre-pandemic wardrobe.
I think I'm one of the strange ones who enjoyed wearing a face mask everywhere. You know, I enjoyed looking like an old-time bandit at the grocery store and even at the bank.
I have these beautiful dresses. They're really sweet. I'm in my closet right now, and there's this polka dot dress that I love and this other dress that has, like, vine patterns. I want to wear those again.
I am so tired of trying to put on a pair of skinny jeans that I cannot bend my knees in.
Hard pants just are really out.
And also, can we talk about the fact that high heels are really uncomfortable? So, no more heels.
Yeah, so why did we ever bother with high heels? Or ties, or belts, or hard shoes with laces when Velcro does the trick just fine? After this year, how much effort are we going to be willing to expend on the symbolic value of dressing for the office? One person who's thought a lot about that question is Richard Thompson Ford. Ford is a professor of law at Stanford, and his new book is called Dress Codes. It's about how clothing has maintained social hierarchies throughout history and occasionally upended them. Ford himself, it's worth noting, is no slouch in this department. He once made the semifinals in a best-dressed real man contest hosted by Esquire magazine. The New Yorker's Henry Finder called up Richard Thompson Ford to talk about fashion.
So, Rich, what are you wearing right now?
So I'm wearing one of my favorite jackets. It's almost like a Donegal tweed, but it's blue with a light blue. So it kind of comes off also as almost slightly denimish and a blue shirt.
Now, your background is in civil rights and anti-discrimination law. Why did you want to write a book about clothes?
So there are two reasons. One's personal and one's professional. And the personal reason is I like clothes. I'm a little bit of a clothes horse. And more than that, my father was trained as a tailor, actually. And this was at a time when African Americans in black colleges were often trained in a trade as well as a profession in case racial barriers prevented them from pursuing their profession. And I picked up from him the importance of clothing for him as a black professional navigating some tricky racial dynamics where there weren't very many African Americans. And so clothing and attire became an important way for him to, you know, navigate these racial boundaries. And so that's the personal set of reasons. A professional set is that it was surprising to a lot of people the number of legal disputes that involve dress codes, either in employment discrimination, workplace dress codes that require women to wear makeup or forbid hairstyles that are typically worn by African Americans or that ban religious garb and therefore are challenged as discriminatory. But I always thought the courts didn't really capture what was most important or at stake in these cases because they tended to treat dress as trivial. And I always thought that was wrong and missed a lot of the point. So I wanted to dig into it more to get a sense of what was really at stake in all of these disputes about dress codes.
When I'm thinking about dress codes and apparel today, I mean, there's a great quote in your book. It's from the journal Tailor and Cutter from 1931. And it goes, "A loosening of bonds will gradually impel mankind to sag and droop bodily and spiritually. If laces are unfastened, ties loosened, buttons banished, the whole structure of modern dress will come undone. Society will fall to pieces." Now, that seems very relevant right now.
Yes. And so that quote comes from a time when there was a debate around dress reform. And it's, in the book, I talk a lot about these moments of dress reform movements where some group of people will say, you know, these conventions are ridiculous. And this was a point where men were rebelling against starched collars and neckties and all of the other things that men at that time needed to wear. And certainly we're seeing a real acceleration of that mentality today, where a lot of people would say, you know, dress doesn't matter, fashion doesn't matter, people should just wear whatever is comfortable. I am skeptical that people will ever stop caring entirely about what other people are wearing. And, you know, we are struggling with what comes next. On the one hand, it seems a little silly and, let's say, inauthentic to dress up too much to be on Zoom. Everyone knows you're in your living room. And yet, the desire to express oneself through fashion remains. You get very subtly expressive forms of athleisure. Mm.
You know, this year has also been one of significant political upheaval, from last summer's protests against police brutality, deeply divisive election, the riot at the Capitol in January. How do you see clothes functioning politically at these events?
Yeah, it's interesting that in the earliest Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, it seemed that everyone was wearing, just whatever. You didn't see much of a coordination. And, in a sense, that sent a message as well of an outpouring of humanity, an outpouring of outrage and concern over the question of spontaneity. Yes. But, as the protests continued, you started to see dress codes. You saw, for instance, in Brooklyn, transgender people protesting police violence, all wearing suffragette white. You had African-American men in Harlem dressed in suits and ties in order to show their respect for the victims of police violence. And then you had a protest in South Carolina where the organizers actually said, we ask people to come in their Sunday best. And they were quite explicit that they wanted to make reference to the civil rights movement of the early 1960s, where people wore their Sunday best to desegregate lunch counters, or in the March on Washington, for instance. So they made a very deliberate statement with attire.
One of the most fascinating things about the book for me, and the most illuminating, is the discussion of what we always now disparage as respectability politics, which turns out to be more complicated than we might have thought.
Yes, well, the civil rights movement in the 60s is a great example where, from today's perspective, I think a lot of people describe this as respectability politics in the very negative sense that it's about trying to impress the powerful or to, ingratiate oneself with the powerful by wearing this clothing. One person actually, in responding to the South Carolina protest, said, it's going to take more than a necktie to get the noose from around our necks. But that's not what was going on in the early civil rights movement. In fact, if you put it in historical context, Black people wearing refined clothing had been a challenge to white supremacy for generations. For instance, in South Carolina, there was a law called the Negro Act, which prohibited slaves from wearing clothing that was considered to be above their condition. And this expectation that African Americans would dress in shabby clothing continued well past emancipation. Black people wearing their Sunday best, particularly on any day other than Sunday, were attacked by racist mobs. Black people in refined clothing were mocked in newspaper cartoons. And so it was understood at the time that a Black person in this refined clothing was making a demand, in some sense, for dignified treatment. They were saying, I deserve the status that this attire signifies in our society. And so in that context, the Sunday best civil rights activism wasn't just a way to kind of suck up to white people, but quite the opposite. It was a demand for dignity.
That's so fascinating. So it's a transgressive act.
Yes.
And a strategic one. What would you like to see come back in dress codes after the pandemic, after this slovenly year for many? What would... And what would you be fine with losing?
I would like to see a little more refinement and decorum come back, particularly in environments that are either professional or celebratory. You know, I mean, honestly, I think there's nothing that's more depressing than going out for a big celebration, you know, at a fine restaurant, and somebody shows up in, you know, sweats. So I think people have something of a social responsibility to make an effort in certain environments. And what would I like to see left behind? The dress codes that are heavily regulatory of women, I think the one thing I talk about in the book, and it's really quite breathtaking, is just how relentless and just how punishing dress expectations have been for women, and how contradictory. So women are expected to be decorative, but also to be modest. And they're constantly judged and evaluated on their attire. It's very debilitating. It's sexist. It's wrong. Those kind of dress codes I'd love to see go. Dress codes that prohibit hairstyles often worn by African Americans, and again, particularly women, you know, I've come to believe are quite destructive of self-esteem and unjust barriers to advancement. I'd love to see those go. So now there's something called the Crown Act, which is designed to prohibit that kind of dress code. I think that's a great thing, and I hope it passes.
After a year of kind of minimalism and the emphasis on comfort and small details, like, what's the chance that we just go extreme with our fashions in the post-pandemic years?
I think we might see some of that. I mean, for instance, in the part of history that I describe as the birth of fashion in the book, a lot of this is coming off of waves of the plague. And as the plague wanes, you have this explosion of very expressive fashions that are being used both by elites in order to shore up their elite status, but also by, you know, emergent prosperous classes. You know, another example, after the end of the Spanish flu, you get the Roaring Twenties and flapper styles, which were a dramatic departure from earlier women's clothing. But I think that, you know, now you've got this tension where, on the one hand, people want to be unassuming and authentic, and that leads you to more and more casual clothing that's, you know, at least looks practical. But at the same time, people want to be expressive. And being stuck inside on Zoom has denied everyone the opportunity to just go out and kind of see and be seen, as we used to put it. So you've got the popularity of, you know, TV shows that have a like Bridgerton, and now everyone's talking about Regency fashions, or The Queen's Gambit or The Crown, and people are talking about you know, fashions in the 1950s and 1960s. And I think there are a lot of people who can't wait to try some of those out for themselves, or at least to try something that is flamboyant, you know, that says, here I am, now that we're finally out of quarantine.
That's so interesting. And you make a good point. Like, some of the most successful Netflix shows this year, like Bridgerton, Queen's Gambit, even Emily in Paris, they're very fashion-centered. They're all about apparel. And I wonder whether there is that kind of fantasy, this a sense of a lockdown country yearning for that kind of display.
I think there is. I even heard about a group of people who would dress up to take out the trash. You know, they were so, and it turned into like a cocktail party thing, you know, across the street with the trash can. So someone brought out a bottle of wine, and before you know it, there are these neighbors who come out with their trash cans, and then, you know, it dressed up. And there's an Instagram page about it. So if people will do that, you know, I think we're ready to cut loose.
Richard Thompson Ford is the author of Dress Codes: How the Laws of Fashion Made History. He's a professor at Stanford Law School. And Henry Finder is the editorial director of The New Yorker, and a guy who is never, please trust me on this, he is never going to wear sweatpants to the office. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Asian Americans often describe a feeling of not belonging in America, of being made to feel somehow like outsiders, of being in different ways vulnerable. Four Asian American and Pacific Island writers got together recently for the new episode of our poetry podcast, and they spoke about how America's complicated ethnic politics informs who they are and how they write. Here is Kimiko Han, whose collection from last year was called Foreign Bodies.
I've thought of this question, actually, over the decades. It is not across the board, of course, because we are different generations, different generation immigrant. I'm mixed, so part Japanese American. Okay, so there's all that. But I would say that there is very often a psychological vulnerability with language, whether it's English, and English is my first language, or whether it's Japanese, which I don't speak fluently at all. So I feel very, very vulnerable when it comes to speaking and writing, as if I'm not ever going to get it right. And I think that's partly me and, you know, a girl growing up in the 50s and 60s and so on. But I also think it really is received, to use Monica's word again, that I'm not going to be able to express myself as well as someone else, someone more mainstream, white, if you will.
I always think that Asian American writers have taught me that it's okay to be a little bit illegible. You know, I think a lot of Asian Americans are always racialized as forever foreigner, even if your families have been here for a really long time. And that's something that, you know, within that illegibility, or that, as Ocean Vuong puts it, that unfathomability, one has to find other kinds of methods to feel like you have some sort of connection to your homeland, even if your homelands feel really theoretical, right? Depending on when your family came here. And I always think about Mina Alexander, who wrote in the beginning of one of her poems, she said, "In the absence of reliable ghosts, I made an aria." And I love that. In the absence of something that is figurative or spectral, you know, I made a song. And I think about that in terms of, you know, what I can reach to. I can always reach to sort of this sonic place, this kind of hallucinatory place, this sort of surreal place, this multidimensional place where there might be an absence of a real time and space in which I feel like I have to have some sort of archive or history or connection to. And, you know, just to come up with a point, my mother's side is third generation East African. They're part of this large Indian diaspora that, you know, was in Tanzania, and they grew up speaking Swahili. And so often when I'm in spaces where I'm trying to sort of make myself intelligible as Asian American, I also have to find a little bit of comfort in the idea that most of us, I don't think, grew up learning and had like an Indian Ocean diaspora history class. And so, you know, where I learned a lot of my politics of resilience was actually from a lot of Black writers, right? And I think that that's also an important thing to say, is that the way that Black and Asian and South Asian solidarity sort of come together has been an important way of making myself intelligible, reading June Jordan just as well as reading Mina Alexander.
That's Megan Fernandez. Kimiko Han spoke before her, and they appear with Paul Tron and Monica Yoon this month on the New Yorker's Poetry Podcast, which is hosted by our poetry editor, Kevin Young. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Now, as vaccination numbers go up, some of us who've been playing it cautiously for so long are finally starting to get out in the world. For Hilton Alls, a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and critic at The New Yorker, once he got that second shot, he headed straight to the Metropolitan Museum for a press opening.
Yeah, so Thursday was the day that I was like, woohoo, like, party, orgies. Like. And by way of greeting, you tell people how much you've been vaccinated, and if you had two, then you could hug and all of that stuff. So I think that's going to be the social language for a while.
Was the Met the first museum you went to?
I don't think I've been above 23rd Street, you know?
Hilton was at the Met along with producer Emily Botine to see the exhibit called Alice Neal, People Come First. Alice Neal was a portrait painter. Her subjects were her neighbors, her acquaintances, friends, and other artists. And in her generation, the art world was dominated for a long time by abstraction, by such male contemporaries as Mark Rothko and Jackson Pollock. Painting people in that time, Neal was way off to the side of things, and she was unknown for many years. Then the times finally caught up with her. And at the age of 74, Alice Neal had her first major museum show, a retrospective at the Whitney. Hilton Alls writes that Alice Neal painted a new, diverse America, populated by men of color, single mothers sitting on stoops and children in repose. There is no other in her unsatirical, pointedly political work. Just us, without tears.
What floor? Is it two?
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Alice Neal was a woman who was born at the turn of the last century who wanted to be an artist. And she wanted to be an artist at a time when the world said no, or you paint plates or you make silhouettes. This show is a testament to saying yes to yourself. She painted the world that she knew. So that was in Greenwich Village, but largely in Harlem and the Upper West Side. And the world that she was interested in was very different than the world she was supposed to represent, which was supposed to be genteel Pennsylvania. She was interested in worlds that were not deemed acceptable.
So when you first encountered Alice Neal, was it more her paintings about...
It was everything, really. I love this section. I call it the queer corner of the exhibition because a lot of these subjects are gay men. So, for instance, Ravi Tillotson, who was painted in 73, I love his socks in particular. They're a particular kind of silk sock that men wear with evening pumps, generally. This is a portrait of Henry Geltzahler, who was the first curator of contemporary art at the Met. In 1967, he would, of course, been very aware of Alice, who was starting to be discovered. I like particularly the hands. There's a way in which he's sort of shooing her away. Jackie Curtis was a drag queen. And one of the more extraordinary things about this painting is the hole in Jackie's stockings, the toe peeking out there.
You don't see the toes. Yeah, but you see it. Like it popped out of the...
How many of these feel sort of like old friends to you?
I think when I was in college in 1981, I first came across her and I immediately went to the library because there was no such thing then as, there was no queer studies or African American studies or anything. And she was this person who was doing all of that in her work.
And you were a young
20, yeah. So I've been loving her a long time. I'm old now. One of the things that happened to me on Monday when we came was that I had to kind of keep leaving the space because the spirits were so powerful of the sitters. These works are true collaborations. You can't do this kind of painting without wanting to understand what you're looking at and who you're looking at, and also the sitter giving of themselves. Oh, this is a great room. So this is the mother of them all are a famous Warhol portrait, and he had been shot in 1968 and always had to wear girdles to help keep his insides inside. And it's a measure of his trust in her that he took his shirt off to do it. It's also a measure of her understanding of what it meant to be wounded. I love her for that and for many things, including her ability to see who we are. Should we go down? This is a work that I had never seen before. It's called Marxist Girl, and it shows a girl sitting on a purple chair, and she's wearing sailor pants, which was a style back then. But what I love, too, is that her underarm hair is very important, and also the sort of relaxation and odalesque quality of it. I had never seen this work before, and I was blown away. Alice keeps surprising me.
I was reading some of the stuff you wrote about her.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote, "Neil has the power to make us all feel less lonely in whatever roles nature and society has given us."
Yes, I agree. I have nothing to add to that. I agree completely. Wow, look at the line. I'd say easily there are about 300 people waiting to get in. She'd be thrilled. I think she would have been here every day, sort of happy to talk to people after so many years of obscurity, you know? It's thrilling.
You can find Hilton Alls' writing about Alice Neal, People Come First, at newyorker.com. And the show, an astonishing one, is at the Metropolitan Museum of Art well into the summer. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program for today. Thanks for listening. And I hope you'll join us next time, because we've got a story about how a tragic moment in American history got one aspiring young artist to create a new rap scene in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
My friends had a studio, and I would leave football practice to record with them. It was like, how the fuck am I supposed to make it in rap in Oklahoma? And people from outside the cities would tell us, like, don't say you from here. Don't nobody want to hear nobody from here. You know what I'm saying?
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses,
Annabelle Bacon,
and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.